the 83rd edition of Free City Radio. I'm your host, Stefan Christoph. Thank you for tuning in. On the program today, I'm going to be featuring a conversation I had with longtime anti-poverty organizer John Clark. John organized for years with the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty in Toronto, OCAP, and right now is actually teaching at York University, looking at social movements. This conversation is part of a series of exchanges that I'm working on through Free City Radio in collaboration with the Breach Media Project. And they are looking at basically the reality of a minority government in Canada. The elections that happened in the fall brought another minority government for Justin Trudeau's Liberal Party. And really, we wanted to visit a series of conversations here to look at what social movements can do to respond to this political situation. How can demands be made? What do those demands look like? Can street level and community level organizing play a role in attaining tangible gains for social movements, for poor working people, communities struggling with systemic oppression, Indigenous communities, and migrant communities? What would it look like to really sort of seek out tangible campaign goals and victories for social movements at this time in Canada? So this is part of a series of conversations that I'm working on with the Breach Media. Look them up. Here's my full conversation with John Clark. There'll be an excerpt and some text to accompany it on the Breach, and you can look that up soon. And here's my conversation with John. I'm joined by longtime social justice activist in Toronto, John Clark, who has organized against poverty, of course, with the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, and is now teaching at York University. I reached out to John as part of this series for The Breach about what social movements are doing to respond to the political reality in Canada, a minority government in the context of COVID and the pandemic. So there's lots to get into here, but first I'll just say hi. Hi, John.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. Thanks for doing this. So I guess maybe we can just start first around the crisis of homelessness. And I mean, there's a lot of systemic issues at play there, but Toronto downtown, there's been very important actions that have taken place around the tent city and the violence of both security services, the police, in terms of not recognizing the magnitude of the crisis. And when it's has been, you know, articulated, people are facing not just the systemic violence, but the actual physical violence. So what has happened at Tent City in Toronto, and why is it important in this contemporary moment?
Well, what you've seen, I mean, and it's by no means confined to Toronto, very much a very gruesome episode along the same lines unfolded in Halifax, for example. Certainly people in Vancouver and cities across the country experiencing this, but no question that Toronto, for various reasons, constitutes an epicenter with regards to the crisis of destitution. People come to Toronto because it's a major center, and also in terms of the winters here, they're not really as bad even as Montreal or Ottawa. So, you know, for various reasons, people are drawn to try to survive in Toronto. And during the pandemic crisis, if homelessness constitutes an act of social abandonment by the people who run society, then obviously this was the ultimate expression. In the middle of a pandemic, people were not adequately protected. And one of the ways in which people reacted was to band together and form encampments, often, not always, but often in public parks. Now, that's not a unique phenomenon that we've never seen before, but what we saw is a complete proliferation. for people who are familiar with the situation of visible homelessness in Vancouver, for example, you start to see in public parks something that resembles that, right? So what then, of course, unfolds is that the city makes, sort of is not sure quite how to respond. The thing is clearly in a very bad situation. They're not prepared to take the measures necessary to provide a really adequate alternative. And then what happens is the pandemic starts to come to an end, or they believe they're close enough to the end that they can start to think in terms of business as usual again. And so clearly these parks have become for them an enormous problem that they're not prepared to see institutionalized. And so they start to organize brutal, really brutal major police operations to clear people out. And that's what we've seen in several examples of this. And it speaks to the homeless crisis, and it speaks to the enormity of a city where 40% of the world's mining capital is raised on the stock exchange, a city of enormous wealth that is capable of such brutal acts against people whose only crime is to be rendered destitute by this society. But it speaks to, I think, broadly, because we can see homelessness is only an extreme example of the whole agenda that this society is inflicting on people. It speaks to what kind of a recovery are we talking about? What is the post-pandemic reality? Joe Biden and his G7 friends get together in Cornwall and talk about build back better. But I think there's a snippet, a slice of life about the possibilities for building back better if this system is left to its own devices. So in and of its own right, an enormous injustice, but an injustice that speaks to something much broader as far as I'm concerned.
Can you just share a little bit about the ways that social housing policy, particularly on the part of the Liberal government today, but also going back to the 1990s with the neoliberal cuts to social housing and particularly to cooperative housing that happened in a previous Liberal government. So I'm bringing this up because I think often there's this sort of understanding that there's economic inequality and people are experiencing this extreme economic injustice. They end up homeless. However, there's these actual policy decisions that create the context for this. So I'm just wondering, particularly around the Liberal Party, can you highlight a few concrete moments that are important to understanding the policies that have led to this situation?
Well, I mean, the whole neoliberal period from the 1970s through to recent times has been obviously a process of intensified exploitation and of gutting, amongst other things, gutting of the social infrastructure, the systems of social provision. Margaret Thatcher infamously said there's no such thing as society. The notion that governments don't play a role or should play a substantially reduced role in providing for the needs of people. It's an historical anomaly in that this country, you have a conservative party that is supposedly the hard cutting edge, and then you have a more centrist and mild and moderate liberal party. But in fact, the process of dismantling the social infrastructure, at the federal level, the liberals played the key role. It was Chrétien and Martin who in the 90s devastated income support systems and social assistance systems throughout the country by destroying the Canada Assistance Plan and other such things. And in the realms of housing, it is them and it is the Liberal Party that played the absolutely decisive role in pulling the federal government and then the provinces followed suit, pulling them out of the provision of social housing. So the lion's share of the situation is really in the lap of the Liberal Party and not the Conservatives, actually, not to deny the role of Stephen Harper and Brian Mulroney and all these things. They were enormous, but the Liberal Party played the absolutely decisive role. And recently you have Justin Trudeau's infamous national housing strategy that was mockingly referred to in a piece that was co-written by Gene Swanson, who's now a councillor in Vancouver, labelled it a national gentrification strategy. The whole idea was to provide inducements to private development and to really destroy any commitment even further to any system of public housing or social housing. So the kind of talk that, you know, that we hear today coming from Trudeau, his national housing strategy, or now he's got a housing minister that he's appointed and this kind of thing, it's just fluff. It's just fluff to cover the reality. We've arrived at a situation. Toronto City Council just had a major initiative on the same lines. We've reached a point where on Toronto City Council, both right and dubiously left are united around the proposition that something like social housing is a complete anachronism. You wouldn't even consider something like that. What is required is to provide inducements to developers and private interests so that as they go about this reckless drive to create an absolutely unsustainable bubble of luxury housing, they will throw in a few extra units of dubiously affordable housing for poor people. So, yes, I mean, in the area of housing, the situation is utterly out of control. I mean, I just see a piece came across my news feed suggesting that in Ontario at the moment, 25% of home sales are speculative ventures, are bought up by people who are not going to live in them. I mean, housing, the commodification of housing and its treatment as a commodity has become one of the linchpins of the whole brutal, inhuman agenda that's unfolding. And in the process is creating a speculative bubble that is threatened to drag down the Canadian economy as a whole.
Okay, so on this point of speculation and housing market, there's been no real moves also from the, you know, at least affiliating in a public sense to left ideas. The Projet Montréal administration in Montreal has done very little to confront real estate capital and the proliferation of condos and speculative housing developments. I know it's the same in Toronto. Can you just talk about the ways that, like, just from all your experience, like, to actually address these issues, there needs to be a confrontation. But the sort of like liberal approach or like social democratic approach in the context of Projet Montréal is that there's no confrontation with real estate capital.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it needs to be said that we need to understand that in Canada, we have at the moment the worst situation, right? I mean, the gap between real income and house prices in Canada has opened up in a way that nowhere within the OEDC, with the possible exception of New Zealand, do you see such disparities. The unaffordability of housing, it's grim in Toronto. It's considerably worse than that in Vancouver, has opened up in ways that have, with the exception perhaps of Hong Kong, there are no comparisons. And so the degree of speculative parasitism that is eating away at the provision of the vital social and human need of housing has no rival anywhere else in the developed world. The situation at the moment with regards to the housing bubble is actually far worse than it is in the United States, and worse than it was before the 2008 crash in the United States. So that's the reality of the situation. And the notion that all we can do is win some crumbs from the developers' banquet table is a disgusting parody of the idea of building social movements and engaging in struggles. I mean, the housing front is probably one of the key ones. And it speaks with particular clarity to the whole question of what the post-pandemic future is going to look like. and those who hope it's going to be some new Keynesian golden age brought delivered to us from on high, I think are making the greatest mistake possible. We see, and I don't seem, I'm not just, this is not just a tale of woe. I'm not trying to sort of spell out the notion that it's hopeless. We've seen during this pandemic across the world, the capacity of people to fight back, right? The Black Lives Matter mobilization following the murder of George Floyd was the greatest mobilization that had taken place in the United States, even greater than during the period of the civil rights and the ghetto rebellions. We've just seen the Indian farmers win this historic victory over Modi and his attempt to turn India into a neoliberal laboratory. I mean, an incredible fight back. And we've seen those fights resonate in Canada as well. We've seen these mobilizations happening. We're seeing right now Wet'suwet'en and land defenders giving a lead. We've seen people resist the agenda of abandonment. We've seen impressive mobilizations against evictions taking place. We're seeing the beginnings of a revival of militancy within the trade union movement. I mean, these things are all enormously important, but I think that's the way forward. It's to believe that those in economic and political power are going to be appealed to and are going to try and invent a kinder, gentler brand of capitalism. I think that's always a delusion, but at the moment, it's a deranged folly to think in those terms.
Just on this particular point around, thank you so much for sharing all that, John. The particular point around the idea of giving incentives to developers to include some subsidized housing units, some people sort of point to that as, you know, a fix, some sort of move in the right direction. Can you just underline a bit more why that is not a victory, and also share a bit more about how that doesn't actually amount to an addressing of the crisis of inequality in housing?
Well, I mean, I think it's a mistake. I mean, obviously, if someone receives a subsidized unit, I'm certainly not going to be denouncing anyone who's able to win whatever handhold they can in this highly imperfect situation. But the problem, I think, with the whole approach is that in return for these crumbs, what you're accepting is essentially the hegemony of capitalist vested interests. You're saying, yes, we'll give you the land, we'll stand back, we'll allow you to build whatever you want. You can inflate this massive, unsustainable, speculative bubble that's going to collapse like a house of cards sooner or later. You can do all these things, no matter how destructive, no matter how reckless, no matter how impossible the future you're creating, as long as you just make a few token concessions that we can sell out there when we're seeking re-election and present ourselves as progressives. And I think, no, we can't accept the kind of future that's being built. And I mean, I say this at a time when BC is flooding. I say this at a time when we're dealing with a global pandemic. It must be clear that there is no future that's going to be provided to us by these people, not in housing policy, but not in anything. We've got to fight them. We can't ask them to be just kinder and gentler and nicer, because they can always do that in words. They're very good at, you know, compassionate capitalism and great resets, and they go away to Davos and meet in the Swiss Alps and talk about how wonderful they are. But no, we've got to fight these people. We've got to fight this system. And that's the reality.
So just a final point, like the critique towards like Liberal Party's housing policy. I guess one of the reasons we're recording these conversations is to try to understand the political moment in Canada, because obviously Liberal Party is interested in holding on to power. There's the NDP is holding a balance of power in some ways. What role, like, do you think that social movements can play in challenging confronting, you know, these interests in this moment, because there is a lot more political uncertainty for the Liberal Party?
Yeah, I mean, I think the uncertainty of the Liberal Party is probably the same as the Democrats in the US find themselves experiencing a very similar kind of a situation. The parties of the neoliberal center have become incredibly discredited. So Trudeau clings to power as, again, a minority regime, really by default, really because a clear enough alternative hasn't been created that people are going to move towards it. The Conservative Party is in disarray in various ways, and I would argue that the NDP is certainly suffers from a perennial inability to open up enough daylight between itself and the neoliberal centre, and that creates this situation of minority government. Now, some people see in that an incredible opportunity in and of itself. I mean. This is the second time around on minority governments. And yes, I mean, the NDP put a bit of pressure and there were some measures that were taken that probably wouldn't have happened otherwise and a few minor concessions made. But fundamentally, the Liberals are proceeding with their agenda. They've dismantled the necessarily somewhat elevated income support protections they gave during the period of pandemic lockdown. They're moving to restore an agenda that's going to be highly exploitative and regressive. It may be that minority governments could provide inherently unstable, could be to the advantage of an ascendant and powerful social movement. If we had rejuvenated trade unions and if we had social movements that were massive and powerful, the political crisis of a minority Liberal government would be, I think, advantageous. But only in a very secondary and minor way, as far as I'm concerned, does a minority government in and of itself present some improved possibilities for a progressive agenda. There is no progressive agenda except the one we fight for. And that, I think, is the key lesson that we've got to take into the period ahead. And quite honestly, given that all of the parties in the end will adapt themselves to the prevailing agenda, I'd far sooner, if we had to be absolutely blunt about it, I think we could win more with a powerful social mobilization in this country from a majority Conservative government than we would obtain if we elected an NDP government and just sat back and hope for the best. I think the decisive question is not on Parliament Hill. It's in the workplaces, in the streets, and in the kinds of struggles that we're in a position to take up.
Thanks for taking the time today, John.
Thanks, Stefan.
This was an exchange with John Clark, who is an organizer, a community activist, longtime, really excellent presence in Toronto, who worked for years with the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty and is now teaching social justice studies at York University. John, I think, makes some very important points about the critical importance of social movements in the context of a minority government in Canada, how demands of social movements can be made at this time, and the importance of retaining our support and critical thinking around the possibilities of street-level mobilizations. And I really want to thank John for taking the time. This is part of a series of conversations that I am having with the Breach Media. Basically, we're looking at how, this moment of a minority government in Canada speaks to politically what is possible for activists at this time. So thank you so much to John for being on the program, and thanks to the Breach Media for supporting this interview series. I'll now go to a piece of music that was actually part of a benefit album for the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty. That was called Bakunin's Bum. Two of my friends worked on tracks for that album, Norman Navratsky and Aidan Gert. So this is a track called There's a Place for Everyone, and you'll hear a longtime Ontario Coalition Against Poverty organizer, Sue Collis, speaking. I'll talk to you soon, and please tell a friend about Free City Radio. Encourage them to subscribe to the podcast. I'm Stefan Christoph. If you want to reach me about anything, I'm at stefan.christoff@gmail.com. And I'm on Twitter at Spirodon, Spirodon. And here's There's a Place for Everyone by Bakunin's Bum. Talk to you soon. Take it easy.
there is a place for everybody. And I can't say it enough that I think what is most important, you know, when you're going forward and when we approach things in the way that the uncompromising way that we do, that there's an allowance for people to take their place where they see their place as being in that. You know, while on one hand, you know, people aren't dismissed or you know, lectured, whatever, for throwing a rock at a cop's head, at the same time, you know, people aren't dismissed for being at the back of a crowd either, or for, you know, doing research for the organization on an issue that we're working on, or for, you know, being a, you know, a person who maintains our radio show or puts together that publication, or, you know, does intake work for cases or represents people in court. I mean, there's all these different elements, and I don't think that we can worry about alienation in the sense that I think it's vital to put out there what your organization stands for, and the fact that we will defend ourselves physically when that, you know, needs to happen, that we will fight physically when that needs to happen, because otherwise people don't know what they're signing on for. Otherwise it's a lie. And people have to be able to make that decision because it's fair and just for that person, but also because we have to, you know, we want people who agree with us to come to our organization. We don't want to have to deal with, you know, debates around these issues when that is solidly and wholly and conclusively, you know, how we operate and what our orientation is. So,
feminism and technology through space and time.
Good morning. You're listening to the F-Files on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, or CKUT.ca on the web. Today is January 5th, 2022. And I'm going to start this first show of the year off by playing a nice long piece by Eliane Radig. The title is Girlande, and this is a composition from 1972 featuring a prepared piano and an ARP 2500 synthesizer. And I think it's nice to play this here at the beginning of the year because Eliane Radig has a really particular way of working with time. Her work is really kind of deep and changes very slowly. The timbres kind of shift in these very subtle ways, and so that her work or her pieces feel almost infinite, or you kind of lose track of linear time while listening to them. So I hope that you enjoy it.